is just this the radical question, left.
Will you shut
who is
up,
your,
man.
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This
Who's
is
on
so
your list?
Gentlemen,
this is,
I think
this we've is ended so this. Unprecedented.
He's going to pack the court.
We have
give a list.
We have ended this segment. We're going to move on to the second segment.
That was really a productive segment, wasn't it?
Of course, the Democratic Party had another candidate besides Joe Biden. 78-year-old Bernie Sanders was another lesser-known candidate of the Democratic Party, a leftist senator who had different things to say than his rivals. The elderly Bernie Sanders made a strange promise to his supporters just a few days before the internal party debate. In the form of a proposal, he promised to completely forgive student debt. This promise seemed strange, but there was an even stranger issue. Bernie Sanders announced an incredible figure for American student debt. He said that American students owed about $1,600 billion to the U.S. banks. He said that the new generation must not be in debt during the lifetime due to the crime of studying at the university.
This proposal completely eliminates student debt in this country and ends the absurdity of sentencing an entire generation, the millennial generation, to a lifetime of debt for the crime of doing the right thing, and that is going out and getting a higher education.
The university system in America is more like a black box. Even the people who work inside the university are not properly aware of its conditions. Of course, the only obvious thing is the increasing number of young people entering universities. Young people and their families have to borrow from banks if they have not saved extra money for education. Banks take a financial commitment from students in exchange for paying the tuition fees. This financial commitment is considered in installments of several years. There is also another point. The interest of this amount of money increases day by day, and if students don't get a job, they will have to pay back more. So the figure that Bernie Sanders mentioned in his speech was not so unusual.
There is now more than $1.7 trillion in student loan debt. And this isn't just some sort of, you know, young person millennial issue. This really touches every facet of American lives, both individuals, their communities, our economy, and our country.
Their rankings made them to be a model for other scientific centers in the world. According to this institution, the rating criteria can be summarized in several points: the number of Nobel and Fields medals, the number of influential researchers, and the number of scientific articles. Although the criterion places American universities at the top of the list, there are other issues. The question is, how reliable are these ranking lists? In the last 40 years, the number of professors in relation to students has remained constant, but the number of managers and administrative staff has increased in relation to students. On the other hand, the official employment of professors is somehow over. Now, most of the university professors work under a contractual agreement and live in economic insecurity. The current situation is the result of neoliberals in power, like Ronald Reagan.
Conservative governors, especially Governor Reagan of California, had really run on the idea that higher education was a wasteful way to spend taxpayer money. Governor Reagan actually said the state should not subsidize intellectual curiosity. And he ran for president later on a promise to disband the Department of Education.
Certain advisors started to say that anything of a private advantage should be paid for.
The word free is one of the most misused words. We speak of free education. Education isn't free, it costs money.
If this is something that is going to be good for individuals to get a job and earn more money, they should finance it and make the investment themselves.
We need to keep government on the sidelines. Let the people develop their own skills, solve their own problems.
We stopped expanding the franchise of higher education. Graduation rates stopped rising, and access for the poor to higher education started going down.
Politicians like Ronald Reagan divided people into two classes. Their ideal society consisted of two classes, the rich and the poor. They believed that the more people live in economic insecurity, the more docile they become. This dangerous attitude changed the structure of universities in general.
The government will make $184 billion in profits over the next 10 years. All those profits made off the backs of our kids who are trying to get an education.
Now, other universities are more like business enterprises than scientific centers. When academic goals give way to economic goals, something terrible happens to universities. In this time, students are considered customers. Universities need students' tuition, and students need university degrees. Universities try to provide relative satisfaction to students, and students owe money to banks to achieve university degrees. Statistics show that in 1960, only 15% of American students received top academic grades. But today, the story is different. Now, 43% of students receive top academic grades. Of course, this unprecedented growth in statistics does not mean that students are becoming more educated, but it means that universities go easy on them. In simpler terms, universities sell grades to students. The commercial approach to higher education has changed the relationship between professors and students. According to a study, 25% of seniors have never spoken to their professors outside of the classroom. Students don't respect and prize their professors so much, and the effort to acquire knowledge has been replaced by selling grades. Turning the university into a business enterprise has another aspect as well. On the one hand, universities have to provide new facilities to attract customers every year, and on the other hand, these facilities require large budgets. For several years, university administrators have been doing everything to earn more money. This money can sometimes be used to build a swimming pool and sometimes to buy useless items. Students' tuition fees are not alone enough to buy such equipment. Another way to earn money is college sports. At first, we may think that university leagues are held for athletic aims. But the reality is something else. In recent years, prominent sports brands and companies have been using the university's social capital. Sponsorship in exchange for advertisement is what Nike and Adidas are doing. College sports are no longer for the personal and professional growth of students, but for commercial purposes. Companies are the real owners of universities. Universities buy expensive athletes to win against other teams. They win in tournaments and become more famous and receive more money from sponsors.
The philanthropists of the Gilded Age gave us the idea of mass higher education as a basic human right. Peter Cooper was this industrialist who believed in education as free as water and air. He founded the Cooper Union, a school of industrial arts and design in New York City, with the idea that it would be available to people, no matter what their background, to study useful and practical arts. But today, the Cooper Union is one of the last examples of a free higher education institution in the country.
A full scholarship for every enrolled student is the current mission statement of Cooper Union.
Peter Cooper wanted the school to be accessible to the working class, to women, to people of color. I come from a lower middle class family. My parents told me about Cooper, and when I found out, like, I was like obsessed. I didn't even think about going anywhere else.
Nowadays, so much is against this 19th century model of a free education. Ideologically, financially, it's ancient.
New economic policies have changed everything over the decades, including the free education in some universities in the United States. In the middle of the 19th century, when Peter Cooper founded the Cooper Union, he had no other goal than free education. He rented properties to offset the costs of the university to achieve his goal. But everything changed 150 years later.
After 18 months of intense analysis, the Board of Trustees voted last week to charge tuition for all undergraduates admitted to Cooper Union, beginning with the class of 2014.
In 2011, the then president of Cooper Union declared that the costs were so high that they had to end free tuition policy. Students started protesting after hearing the decision. Some of them decided to take real actions. They could only occupy the university president's office.
We, the students of the Cooper Union for the Advancement of Science and Art, can no longer uphold or endorse the direction our college has taken under the leadership of Jamshed Barucha. By voting no confidence today, join us in keeping Cooper Union free to all.
Protests over monetizing higher education don't only take place in the U.S. In March 2018, students launched protests in Santiago, the capital of Chile. They protested against the government's new decision. The Chilean government decided to allow universities operate for profit, and this meant the end of free education.
In Chile, students have clashed with police in the capital, Santiago. They say the president's educational reform plan hasn't gone far enough. The government is improving teachers' pay and giving additional funds for poor students, but hasn't given the free university education students are demanding.
The protests in Chile soon turned incredibly violent. People who wanted to make money from education were not willing to change their minds. Private universities were considered a major challenge for some countries. Across a span of years, private institutions have emerged in Brazil, but their aim was not educational at all. These institutions provide loans to students to begin higher education. Of course, the repayment of these types of loans is the same as in the US. Students who receive this loan must work during the day and go to university at night. Otherwise, they can't repay their loans.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 3! For many of us, it was the first time being in the president's office. We have like this red light that we show to say that we're occupying the space.
Students at the Cooper Union did not stop their strike for the same reason. They occupied the then Cooper Union president's office for several months. Repeated talks with the students were not fruitful because the university officials did not want to change their decision.
Now, I know this has been a difficult time for the Cooper Union community.
There is anger, there is disappointment over the tuition issue, but the debate you're having really isn't about whether education is free. It's really a debate about who can and who is willing to pay for it. There's nothing really free in life.
University officials did not consider free education as the right of the people. The students also decided to continue their protests in another way. After 65 days of sit-in protest, the demands of the students were almost fulfilled. But it only lasted 2 years. The board of directors of Cooper Union unanimously decided to demand tuition for students. Consequently, the free education became a myth. Until a few decades ago, it was difficult to get a university degree, and academic goals were considered the most important motivation for students. But everything changed with the emergence of capitalist ideology. Now, university degree is nothing but a product. Achieving a degree is possible not by hard work, but also by other means. Education has systematically tried to inculcate credentialism. Most jobs require a college degree, and one should pay money to get it. Writing articles, research papers, and having new ideas are not that much important now. Today, students are concerned about repaying loans, finishing their studies, and getting degrees. A university degree is only considered a value, and it is not important how you get it.
When you look at higher education, what you realize is what you're paying for is this mythical, large bundle of things that you're supposed to get. So I'm here to give you a framework to look at what types of services you could be accessing that could either supplement or kind of replace going to college. So I've unbundled college into three parts. The first is engaging with content you're supposed to learn. So it could be through a lecturer and transferring content to you. Then there's an affiliate network, enduring relationships with people that are going to look out for you, that are going to help you find opportunities. And the third is a credential of accepted value, which is literally a piece of paper that kind of certifies that you have met some minimum level of competency. When I went to school, there was no way to access the services that higher education provided easily and freely or cheaply on the internet. And it turns out, well, now you kind of can't.
Of course, there are people who believe that the age of university is over. They believe that the education should be hacked like a computer system. Their goals became more clear in San Francisco. They withdraw from the university and believe that learning sciences and making connections with others are not exclusive to the university. They consider a university degree as a piece of paper only for self-glorification. What is important for them is to acquire real skills and relationships. In this method, they forget about the normal ways. They don't endanger their future by getting loans. This is a practical and useful way of learning. These people try to stand against the university that acts like an industry that makes a profit by unethical methods.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The ratings agency Fitch has downgraded the credit ratings of the United States, saying the country's growing debt and repeated standoffs over the borrowing limit make it less trustworthy than before. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CNBC has covered this story and tells us more. A Fitch rating analyst warned that the U.S. banking industry has inched closer to another source of turbulence, the risk of sweeping rating downgrades on dozens of U.S. banks that could even include the likes of J.P. Morgan Chase. The ratings agency cut its assessment of the industry's health in June, a move that analyst Chris Wolfe said went largely unnoticed because it didn't trigger downgrades on banks. But Chris Wolfe told CNBC, another one-notch downgrade of the industry's score to A+ from AA- would force Fitch to reevaluate ratings on each of the more than 70 U.S. banks it covers. Chris Wolfe added, if we were to move it to A+, then that would recalibrate all our financial measures and would probably translate into negative rating actions. The credit rating firms relied upon by bond investors have roiled markets lately with their actions. Recently, Moody's downgraded 10 small and mid-sized banks and warned that cuts could come from another 17 lenders, including larger institutions like Truist and U.S. Bank. Earlier this month, Fitch downgraded the U.S. long-term credit rating because of political dysfunction and growing debt load, a move that was derided by business leaders, including J.P. Morgan Chase's chief executive officer, Jamie Dimon. Chris Wolfe said, Fitch is intent on signaling to the market that bank downgrades, while not a foregone conclusion, are a real risk. The firm's June action took the industry's operating environment score to AA- from AA because of pressure on the country's credit rating, regulatory gaps exposed by the March regional bank failures, and uncertainty around interest rates. The problem created by another downgrade to A+ is that the industry's score would then be lower than some of its top-rated lenders. The country's two largest banks by assets, that is J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America, would likely be cut to A+ from AA- in this scenario, since banks can't be rated higher than the environment in which they operate. And if top institutions like J.P. Morgan Chase are cut, then Fitch will be forced to at least consider downgrades on all their peers' ratings, according to Chris Wolfe. That could potentially push some weaker lenders closer to non-investment grade status. Shares of lenders including J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America and Citigroup dipped in pre-market trading on Tuesday, 15th of August. For instance, Miami Lakes, Florida-based Bank United at BBB is already at the lower bounds of what investors consider investment grade. If the firm, which has a negative outlook, falls another notch, it would be perilously close to a non-investment grade rating. Chris Wolf said he didn't want to speculate on the timing of this potential move or its impact on lower rated firms. Chris Wolf added, "We've had some decisions to make, both on an absolute and relative basis. On an absolute basis, there might be some BBB banks where we've already discounted a lot of things and maybe they could hold on to their rating." JP Morgan Chase declined to comment for this article, while Bank of America and Bank United didn't immediately respond to messages seeking comments. In terms of what could push Fitch to downgrade the industry, the biggest factor is the path of interest rates determined by the US Federal Reserve. Some market forecasters have said the Federal Reserve may already be done raising interest rates and could cut them next year, but that isn't a foregone conclusion. Higher interest rates for longer than expected would pressure the industry's profit margins. Analysts said that downgraded banks would have to pay investors more to buy their bonds, which further compresses profit margins. They even expressed concern that some banks could get locked out of debt markets entirely. Downgrades could also trigger unwelcome provisions in lending agreements or other complex contracts. Chris Wolf said, "It's not inevitable that it goes down. We could be at AA- for the next 10 years, but if it goes down, there will be consequences." American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story and tells us more. Fitch Ratings Agency downgraded the credit ratings of the U.S. recently, saying the country's growing debt and repeated standoffs over borrowing limit make it less trustworthy than before. Fitch downgraded the United States from a rating of AAA to AA+, after several years of high-risk partisan battles over the debt limit. Those battles, Fitch said, had led to a spiraling national debt and a lack of faith in the U.S. government to handle it. Fitch wrote, "There has been a steady deterioration in standards of governance over the last 20 years, including on fiscal and debt matters, notwithstanding the June bipartisan agreement to suspend the debt limit until January of 2025. The statement added, "The repeated debt limit political standoffs and last-minute resolutions have eroded confidence in fiscal management." Fitch's downgrade comes roughly 3 months after President Joe Biden signed a deal to raise the debt limit just days before the U.S. was expected to default on its national debt. Fitch warned then that the growing debt, now well over $32 trillion, and Congress's inability to manage it in a productive and responsible way pose threats to the country's creditworthiness. Fitch said on Tuesday, 1st of August, "The government lacks a medium-term fiscal framework, unlike most peers, and has a complex budgeting process. These factors, along with several economic shocks as well as tax cuts and new spending initiatives, have contributed to successive debt increases over the last decade. Additionally, there has been only limited progress in tackling medium-term challenges related to rising Social Security and Medicare costs due to an aging population." Fitch also cited increased political polarization and partisanship as witnessed by the contested 2020 election in its June warning. The agency released its recent downgrade within moments of former President Donald Trump's indictment for his conduct and leading up to the 6th of January 2021 riots at the U.S. Capitol. The downgrade is an embarrassing blow for the U.S. government, which has long been considered one of the safest borrowers in global finance. Trillions of U.S. dollars and treasury bonds lay the foundation for the U.S. financial system. That has allowed the federal government to rack up limitless debt without economic blowback. While the ratings downgrade may have a largely symbolic impact, it comes as the United States and other major powers face rising interest rates. The U.S. Federal Reserve has boosted its baseline interest rate by 5.5 percentage points since March of 2022 as the central bank battles inflation. A lower credit rating may push U.S. interest rates even higher, though global market conditions could dampen the full impact. However, the timing of the downgrade did raise eyebrows among some economists.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be examining a question, very delicate, kind of controversial. And that question is related to one of the pseudosciences or occult sciences known as astrology. As you know, there's a difference between astronomy and astrology. Astronomy is the science of the genesis, destruction, and movement of heavenly bodies, such as planets and stars and these kind of things. But astrology is a field where they study the effects that the movement of these bodies and their placement in the skies have on a person's faith, which, you know, pretty much everybody these days is aware of. And as you know, we have many traditions which kind of dissuade us from pursuing and investigating into, astrology and not listening to the predictions of the astrologers. Like, for example, one hadith is the following. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "O people, beware of learning astrology, except for that which is used for guidance in the land or the sea." So this is an allusion to astronomy, in studying the stars so you can be aware of, you know, your place in the earth or where you are in the sea, which is what they used to do in the past. Obviously, these days it has another function. In any case, then in continuation, the Imam said, "Because it," meaning astrology, "leads to divining, and an astrologer is like a diviner, and the diviner is like a sorcerer. And a sorcerer is like the disbeliever, and the disbeliever will be in hell." So the question we want to pose is, why have we been dissuaded from pursuing such a science, or what is the reason for this, or in what situations, let's put it this way, what situations would we should we avoid pursuing these kind of things? It's interesting that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam himself was asked about this. When asked about what was popularly held among people that the studying of the stars was prohibited and harmful to religion, he answered in the following way. "It is not as they say. It does not harm your religion." He then said, "You are looking into something," meaning a science, "where too much of it cannot be achieved and too little of it cannot be benefited from." All right, so in this hadith, the Imam distinguishes between astronomy and something else, but doesn't clearly say what that is. All he says is that you're looking and investigating into something else, that in order to arrive at the effects, the true effects of that science, you have to study, you know, a lot of it, which is impossible. If you don't study enough of it, then, you cannot achieve the result that you expect from it. Apparently, what the Imam is trying to say is this, that if one were to were able to arrive at a detailed and intricate knowledge of the entire universe, then one could, using that knowledge, could predict, right, what was to happen in the future. But because this is, it's humanly impossible for any normal human being to have such a knowledge, right, what happens is that a person, he arrives at a partial knowledge of, you know, the situation and the position of the heavenly bodies and so on and so forth. And because of that, he makes an incorrect and imprecise precision of what's going to happen in the future. And there's another hadith which is similar to this, which, you know, echoes the same theme. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, "It is a science whose benefits are few and whose harms are many. An astrologer contradicts Allah in his knowledge, claiming he is refuting Allah in his fate over his creation." Right? So if, you know, this study leads us to, you know, the point where we begin to contradict, you know, the knowledge of Allah and refute Allah, then in this situation, it becomes prohibited. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the prohibition of astrology and why it has been, we have been dissuaded from pursuing it. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
Majority of adults in the United States say U.S. laws and policies do a poor job of representing what most Americans want on issues ranging from the economy to government spending to gun policy, immigration, and abortion. We take a look at some of the World Press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Associated Press news agency has covered this story and tells us more. According to a new opinion poll, only about 1 in 10 American adults give high ratings to the way democracy is working in the United States or how well it represents the interests of most Americans. Majority of adults in the U.S. say laws and policies do a poor job of representing what most Americans want on issues ranging from the economy to government spending to gun policy, immigration, and abortion. The new opinion poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research shows that 53% of the American public says Congress is doing a bad job of upholding democratic values, compared with just 16% who say it's doing a good job. The findings illustrate widespread political alienation as a polarized country limps out of the pandemic and into a recovery haunted by inflation and fears of recession. In interviews, respondents worried less about the machinery of democracy, voting laws and the tabulation of ballots, and more about the output. Overall, about half the country, or 49%, say democracy is not working well in the United States, compared with 10% who say that it's working very or extremely well, and 40% who say only somewhat well. About half also say each of the political parties is doing a bad job of upholding democracy, including 47% who say that about Democrats, and even more, 56%, who say the same thing about the Republicans. Michael Brown, a 45-year-old workers' compensation adjuster and father of two in Bristol, Connecticut, says, "I don't think either of the political parties is doing a good job just because of the state of the economy. Inflation is killing us." Michael Brown added, "Right now, I'm making as much as I ever have, and I'm struggling as much as I ever have." A self-described moderate Republican, Michael Brown has seen the United States falling short of its Democratic promise ever since learning in high school that the Electoral College allows someone to become president while not winning the majority of the national votes. But he's especially disappointed with Congress now, seeing its obsessions as not reflective of the American people's will. Singling out the GOP-controlled House's investigation of President Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, Michael Brown said, "They're fighting over something and it has nothing to do with the economy." He asked Hunter Biden, "What does that have to do with us?" The new opinion poll shows 53% of the American public say views of people like you are not represented well by the government, with 35% saying they're represented somewhat well and 12% saying very well or extremely well. About 6 in 10 Republicans and independents feel like the government is not representing people like them, compared with about 4 in 10 Democrats. Carolyn Kiesling, a researcher at the University of Michigan who participated in the opinion poll, sees troubling signs all around her. A Democrat, she recently moved to a conservative area outside the liberal campus hub of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and worried that conspiracy theorists who believe former President Donald Trump's lies that he won the 2020 election would show up as poll watchers. Her Republican family members no longer identify with the party and are limiting their political engagement. Carolyn Kiesling researches the intersection of public health and politics and sees many other ways to participate in a democracy in addition to voting, from being active in a political party to speaking at a local government meeting. But she fears increased partisan nastiness is scaring people away from these crucial outlets. The opinion poll shows that the vast majority of the American public, 71%, think what most Americans want should be highly important when laws and policies are made. But only 48% of the American public think that's actually true in practice. And views are even more negative when it comes to specific issues. About 2/3 of American adults say policies on immigration, government spending, abortion, and gun control are not representative of most Americans' views. More than half also say policies poorly reflect what the American public want on healthcare and the environment. Joseph DeRito, an 81-year-old retired baker from Elmira, New York, sees immigration policy as not representing the views of most Americans. DeRito, a white political independent who leans Republican and voted for Donald Trump, said, "The government today is all for the people who have nothing. A lot of them are capable of working, but get help." He added, "They just want to give these people everything." Sandra Wyatt, a 68-year-old retired data collection worker and Democrat in Cincinnati, Ohio, blames Donald Trump for what she sees as an erosion of democracy in the United States. Sandra Wyatt, who's black, said, "When he got in there, it was like, man, you're trying to take us back to the day before all the rights and privileges everybody fought for." She added that she's voted previously for Republicans as well. She sees those bad dynamics as lingering after Donald Trump's presidency. Sandra Wyatt said, "We always knew there was racism, but now they're emboldened enough to go around and shoot people because of the color of their skin."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Africa Today, a show that keeps you updated on events taking place across Africa. From the ever-changing political landscape, culture, innovation, and technology, to massive natural resources, we bring the continent closer to you. My name is Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. In the first segment of our program this week, we are focusing on the ongoing civil conflict in Sudan that has left thousands dead amid an unfolding humanitarian crisis. We are asking, why have various peace initiatives failed to stop the fighting? In the second part of our program, we are analyzing the decision by Algeria to phase out the use of French language, which is indeed a legacy of France's long and brutal colonial history in this North African country.
Sudan's protracted conflict. The current conflict between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces has inflicted severe damage to infrastructure, healthcare, education, economy, and society. Chaos started mid-April this year following months-long tensions between the military led by Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and the paramilitary rapid support forces commanded by Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti. Disagreements exploded into a deadly armed conflict in the capital, Khartoum, and other parts of the country. Regional and international efforts to reconcile the two warring factions have so far failed.
According to UN estimates, thousands have been killed and nearly 4 million people have fled their homes. Women and children are bearing the brunt of the war in Sudan, as this UNICEF official explains.
Over 13 million children, that is one in every two children in Sudan, is in need of dire humanitarian assistance. Kids are caught up in the middle of heavy fighting in the Darfur, Kordofan, Khartoum, and other places in Sudan. Kids are fleeing with families, displaced across the country and across borders. They are struggling to get urgent life-saving basic services such as healthcare, clean water, food, shelter. The situation is catastrophic, and sadly, it is deteriorating.
Now, for more on Sudan's protracted crisis, we are joined by Hala Al-Karib. She's a political analyst and women rights activist in Kampala, Uganda. Thanks for your time, madam, today.
Thank you for having me.
Nearly 4 months after the conflict in Sudan started, there appears to be no end in sight to the war of attrition between the two rival generals. Now, briefly tell us the main reason behind this sorry state of affairs.
What happened is the leader of the armed militia has made to be the second in command in the Sudan Security Committee, and after the removal of Bashir, he became also the second man after the leader of the army, General Burhan. The interests of the national army and the interest of other regional countries or countries that are neighboring Sudan has been I would say, conflicted because the rapid support force has grown and became extremely influential and has acquired strong ties and connections to countries around the region.
The East African Regional Body, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or the IGAD, recently proposed that the rival sides in Sudan should consider the deployment of a regional force and new peace negotiations. Sudan's army rejected this proposal. Security analysts believe that an African Union-led intervention force should be in place to accompany ongoing peace processes and ease the humanitarian crisis.
I think it's very, very important to have the African Union involved alongside IGAD, which is an intergovernmental agency that includes Eastern and Horn of Africa countries. I think Sudan needs every support from the African Union and from IGAD, but I think it's also important for the AU and for IGAD to present a very comprehensive proposal that looks at the address the complexity of the current situation in Sudan.
There have been several peace initiatives in Sudan, including the IGAD Regional Initiative, the Egyptian-led efforts, and the Jeddah-mediated talks. Speaking at the summit of all countries neighboring Sudan, held in Cairo mid-July, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed spoke of the need to align together all initiatives aimed at ending the conflict in Sudan.
I would like to underline that such processes, including today's summit, need to align with the IGAD-led and African Union-supported existing initiative. The IGAD initiative has laid out potential pathways, and it's imperative for stakeholders to provide the necessary reinforcement.
We have heard there what the Ethiopian Prime Minister said. Now, do you think that lack of coordination in the mediation process is partly to blame for lack of progress in ending the conflict in Sudan?
I think definitely the lack of coordination is an issue between the different initiatives to address the current brutal conflict that's happening in Sudan. So that's an issue that should be looked into. And I think also what's really important is, is to invest sufficient time and looking at all the actors who are currently playing a role, including regional actors, in the current conflict of Sudan and mapping their position and agreeing on a roadmap to resolve this complex situation, taking into consideration the very, very miserable situations on the ground and the fact that civilians has been utilized as human shields in these conflicts.
Kenyan President William Ruto has taken the initiative to bring together Sudan's warring generals to end the crisis plaguing the country. Now, addressing the media in Djibouti at the 14th Ordinary Summit of Heads of State and Government of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, he said that the regional body will begin a process of an inclusive national dialogue in Sudan.
We have also agreed that in the next 3 weeks, we also begin the process of an inclusive national dialogue to get the people of Sudan the opportunity for them to discuss in their diversity the issues of their country. And the generals will also have the opportunity to send representatives so that we can move the whole country forward.
It is critical to involve other parties that represent the true interests of Sudanese people, like the Sudanese Professionals Association, political parties, and people in refugee camps, etc., to ensure Sudan's transformation towards democracy and peace.
I strongly believe that even in the current mediation platform that's happening in Jeddah, I think it's critical to have civil society representatives available. Because when we speak about, the level of hostilities that is happening on the ground, I think it's only fair to have voices of civil society and groups that can reflect on the actual picture and on the impact of the violence on the ground by both parties on the on the lives of the Sudanese people across the country.
As conflict escalates in Sudan, the need for humanitarian support keeps growing as people continue to die and suffer. According to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, at least 20.3 million individuals in Sudan currently face severe hunger.
Slow and ineffective peace talks have seen the country's devastating humanitarian crisis worsen. Now, what is the situation currently?
I think there is challenges at the moment in terms of processing humanitarian aid and support to Sudanese across the country. And this is basically happening due to several reasons. The first reason, the aid itself, it's taking time to reach Sudan. The second reason, the very poor capacity of the current administration in Sudan to process aid to the populations. And in that sense, I think it's very important that the international regional actors who are willing to help and to support Sudanese people to discuss with the local administration, with the national administrations, clearly the strategy to process aid.
Well, we hope that the warring parties in Sudan will stop the fighting and amicably solve their differences. I'd like to thank our guest, Hala Al-Karib, for her insight today. Let's now share a break before our next topic on how Algeria is stopping the use of French in this country. Stay with us.
Algeria dumps French language.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Algerian authorities have decided to stop using French language at universities and instead students will use English starting this academic year in September.
Many Algerian government ministries are also now exclusively using Arabic instead of French in their official documents. The move to replace French in Algeria comes in the wake of severe political tensions